Broadcasting in HD radio at 88.9 FM, this is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, and KBDH San Ardo. Learn more about HD radio at KUSP.org. Hey everybody, I'm Gary Shapiro, and it's time for From the Bookshelf. In Tokyo, space is at a premium. Millions of people and not a lot of space. Apartments are tiny, restaurants cramped. And yet there's one store in Tokyo that's gigantic and sprawling. It's like two square blocks in size. The store that commands all this space is the Snoopy store. Snoopy is popular all over the world, as are all the characters that appeared for 50 years in the Peanuts comic strip. These characters sprang from the mind of Mr. Charles Schulz. Schulz was an unassuming guy from the Midwest who had ambitions to create his own comic strip. His strip became the comic strip equivalent of the Beatles, a phenomenon. Art historian and novelist David Michaelis has written a full-scale biography of this surprisingly complex cartoonist. The book is called Schulz and Peanuts. David Michaelis, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks for having me here. Yeah, I appreciate it.
I just want to say it's so interesting that you start with Japan.
Yeah.
It's a part of... There's a quality in Japanese poetry called yugen, mysterious depths, and I think the Japanese found so much of the same in Schulz. You start reading Peanuts as a clever American cartoon, and then you discover that something's there that you didn't anticipate, and you're not quite sure why, and why do people everywhere feel that it speaks for them, and why are so many different people under the spell of Peanuts? And I think yugen literally means mysterious vagueness or subtle order of beauty, and I think when you start looking deeply into Peanuts, especially at the quietness of it, the strips that have literally no talking in them, no sound, you really find the kind of almost zen-like quality that I think is very appealing and is very durable. And in Japan, it's a pure art form. They love Schulz's line. They don't have a sense. The translator for the pub for Schulz and Peanuts in Japan was, or is, maybe the poet still, the poet laureate of Japan. And he leaves the original lettering in the speech balloons, and he puts the Japanese translation outside the frame.
So like a little subtitle.
Act of respect. Yes, exactly, yeah.
Hmm.
And I think Japanese culture gives cartoonists the same respect that our society reserves for great authors and playwrights and well-known performers. There's something about the quality of Peanuts in Japan that I find very moving, and I think was always, I think, very exciting for Schulz.
Well, I guess you sort of touched on what the question I was going to ask you, which is what drew you to the story of Schulz. You know, you have written about fine art, but what about Schulz got your attention?
Well, I think you've actually hit exactly the right word, which is story. I think the story of Schulz's life and the creation of Peanuts is what appealed to me when I opened the paper. Newspaper on February 13th, 2000, to discover that he had died, and died not just on any old night, but on the night before the last Peanuts comic strip appeared in the paper. And to me, the idea that he had wanted all his life to be one thing, a cartoonist, and then when he ceased to be that, having, of course, achieved heights and a scope in cartoons and comics and in the syndicated comic strip world that no cartoonist had ever reached before. And when he ceased, all of that ceased to be, he himself ceased to be. It seemed to me an astonishing moment of recognition that Schulz's life and art were very parallel. And I think my sense of him emerged from all of our senses, which was as a child, I in the 60s, I adored him, and I felt close to Linus and felt that Linus mirrored some of my weird little thoughts and gave me a sense of identity and a sense of being part of something larger than myself. The whole Peanuts world, which was coming into its first real force as a popular in popular culture at that time, which was 66, 67, 68, really tuned me into my own sense of a generation, my sense of the world, and my sense of what the world was about. So all that was part of the background for me, but really, the sense I had when I began reading the story of his life after his death was that here was someone who had all his life sensed, believed himself, understood himself to be extraordinary, but was telling the world and was himself under the belief that he was also ordinary. And that tension between the extraordinary talent, the native genius of Charles Schulz, the, the what is at the core of Peanuts, which is a profound understanding of human beings and a man who was able to popularize human human drama, human emotion, human comedy. All of that on a level I actually equate with Shakespeare, because I think the reason we go back to Peanuts frequently is for the same reasons we go to Shakespeare, which is to find out some essential part of ourselves in some way that seems simple, but in fact becomes complex the more you look at it. And I think that Schultz's life was that way. It was told as a simple story. In many ways, he achieved a certain simplicity in the way he lived his life, but there was complexity within him. He was an artist. He may not have been melancholy at all times, but there was melancholy on the page, and he managed to harmonize melancholy in his work with joy and find ways of talking about life that had never been seen on the comics page before.
And did you know that before you launched into your project?
No, it began to be clearer to me what his achievement was all about as I understood it better, as I studied Peanuts more. To come back to Peanuts was really to come back to something almost new to me. The 50s, the Peanuts of the 50s was really a revelation. It was quite subversive in certain ways. It was inverting our ideas about childhood, about American happiness. He was saying things that were much more disquieting than things that Al Capp had been saying in those same years, whose point, I think, in Little Abner was that we're surrounded by crooks and fools. And I think that Americans in the 50s believed a great article, really, of our faith, was that children would be better off than their parents. But and the American vision, really, of childhood, children were supposed to be indestructible. They were supposed to be bouncy. But in Peanuts, the children had already had their childhood happiness mortgaged. They were adults. They had adult concerns. And Schultz really was unflinching in his depiction of cruelty between children, of how this was a world without adults, and no one was happy in it particularly. Paradise it wasn't, but in Charlie Brown's world, the licensed happy person was the dog. You know, Snoopy was the happiest person in that strip in the beginning, and that was really a subversive notion, I think, in our sense of childhood. Also, simply Charlie Brown saying, "I'm depressed and I feel apart and I feel lonely," at a time when Americans were supposed to be very happy. They were supposed to be part of the crowd. You were supposed to be conform and be genuinely happy with American prosperity and all the sense of that life was going to be better. But I think there were people who didn't feel that, and Peanuts spoke to those of us who did feel sort of apart or a sense of at Christmas time with Charlie Brown saying, I should be happy, but I just don't feel it. This was new. This was something utterly different in the comics, that's for sure.
And you think that accounts for the phenomenon of Peanuts?
Well, no, I think he went far beyond those early whispers or those early. I mean, he was talking about things way ahead of his time. What was happiness? The hippie generation took that question up. Who belonged? Who didn't belong? I think that in many ways people looked to Peanuts in different ways as the decades went on. The 60s was a decade of finding oneself, and I think Schultz was saying things about that process, that search, that had not been said before. Snoopy is constantly trying to be something he's not, and it was Snoopy in the mid-60s who with whom the strip really took off. Snoopy was a dog, but he, of course, fantasized. His dream life took over. He began to be everything but a dog. He was an astronaut. He was a World War I flying ace. He was a vulture. Exactly. He was a piranha. He was changeable, and he was suddenly a creature of his own imagining, and of his own fantasies, and of his dreams. And the last thing he ever wanted to be was a dog, and to be actually shot down, and brought back down to earth. Even by something Charlie Brown would say, not necessarily by the Red Baron, but just simply Charlie Brown saying to him, "You know what? Be yourself. You're a dog, and get real." Snoopy coming back to the dependency of having to have his dog dish filled because he's just a dog was really a moment I think everyone can understand in their own life. But in terms of the time, Snoopy wanted to raise his consciousness. He wanted to do that flutter-footed dance step. He wanted ecstasy. He wanted to be pure and free and floating and flying. And when Lucy would come up to him and say, "Why are you dancing? What are you doing?" It was, every over 30 type coming to every young person saying, stop being, you know, stop seeking to be something you're not. Stop seeking to raise your consciousness. I think Schultz's whole post-war wholesomeness, his humility, the friendliness that he had himself, the world that saw him as a very sweet and dear and avuncular guy, was pleased to find in Peanuts the kind of things that Snoopy was doing at the time, as were bikers, as were astronauts, as were hippies. I mean, the one thing that everybody seemed to agree on in 1960s America was Peanuts, and Schultz was the great unifier. He brought the world of the disjointed world of that time together in people's feelings and thoughts about the characters.
We're talking to David Michaelis, who is the author of Schultz and Peanuts, a fantastic biography of Charles Schultz. So you see Schultz as one of those elements that grew out of the 50s and came to fruition in the 60s, like the sexual revolution?
Also in the 60s, his work was, I think, really considered very sophisticated adult humor. And then something happened, which was by the middle of the decade, the TV specials, Charlie Brown Christmas, Great Pumpkin, the Thanksgiving special, and all the merchandising, which really exploded right around that time, 65, 66, 67, made it seem to be, at the same time, a family product, a family entertainment, a children's product. And it was a split that really ran down the middle of Peanuts, because Peanuts was very cutting edge in the early years. Schultz was dealing with topics that were very hot topics at the time, psychiatry, you know, there's a lot of talk about...
Right, instead of having a lemonade stand, she had...
Exactly. And that was a very sophisticated joke, a kite-eating tree. The characters were very flip. They were very cruel to each other. He tapped into a kind of adult humor that you would hear in supper clubs at the time, but he did it in a different way. He did it by harmonizing melancholy with joy, with sadness, with humor. He made people aware that you could have these feelings and you didn't have to be angry about them. You didn't have to be sad about them, but there was a way of using humor and a certain sophistication that let people, I think, freed people from some of their feelings. And I think he intuited kind of the psychology of the nation in some way, literally. He naturally understood how to tap into people's fears, their anxieties, their insecurities, and to make light of it. No Schultz character felt sorry enough for themselves that they burst into tears. They never cried. They never produced anger that was out of control.
Sigh.
A big sigh, exactly. And these were quiet. They did things quietly, and with Lucy, of course, things got kind of loud sometimes.
Lucy
never went postal. She was too smart for that.
Yeah. But so you sort of see the humor of Charles Schultz more aligned with Mort Saul and Shelley Berman than with Hank Ketcham.
Well, I think that he actually did things that Saul never could have done, and I really think that's the point about Schultz is that where Al Capp had been saying things that were, you know, pretty angry, Schultz found a way of saying some of the same things in ways that people could hear and feel rewarded by and enriched by. I don't think he was an angry guy in the page. I don't think he was a melancholy guy. I think he managed to do this harmony that is a very, very tricky thing, and I think he found ways early on in his career and throughout Peanuts to bring, Seinfeld probably wouldn't even exist without it, but to bring these small little incidents of daily life that seem meaningless into a focus that then makes them humorous and makes them revealing. And little tiny, he called them little incidents, I think, is what would be, and he specialized in them in a way that no comic strip ever had before, and they were really the sort of basis for his timing, for his way of looking at the world, and for his way of bringing the characters into focus. Because the characters each have their Dickensian, you know, sort of Pigpen's dirty, and Schroeder's a perfectionist who wants nothing but to love Beethoven and worship at the altar of the master, and Charlie Brown, of course, is ever determined to try to get it right this time. They each have their characterological identity, but Schultz brings something more to it, and he brought a kind of magic realism to what he did four panels a day, day by day, and it built, and it built up to something that it didn't just vanish after the 50s or vanish after the 60s. It kept going, and I think that that's one of the crucial things about Peanuts, that it's not just about a particular time. He stepped out of time. You know, he really was like a, like Aesop. You know, he was like an Aesopian storyteller. You know, we're meant to draw more from the stories than their explicit content. The tale was supposed to be more generalized, and applicable to everyone. You know, I mean, the happiness is a warm puppy was a slogan in the 60s. Doesn't mean that happiness as a warm puppy isn't applicable well beyond its time of being a bumper sticker, so to speak.
Well, so let me just talk a little bit about the art in this strip. And obviously, you had to read every strip. There must be thousands of strips.
17,897, but I had a magic carpet, which was the United Media comic strip library, in which I could read it chronologically or I could read it thematically. I could type in a word like love, and it would bring up every comic strip. That. But I think really that what I was awakened to in terms of the art was that Schultz's pen line was utterly, and his pen technique was the most important thing in some ways to him, because the way he drew the characters, he brought life to them. He brought... Not only did he give them form, but he really brought them into a constant sense of aliveness because of his pen line. Because, in other words, he found a paint quality, he often said, in the way the line itself emerged on the board. And I think the way he drew Charlie Brown, the way he drew Linus's hair, the way he drew particular things about the characters, made you feel that there was something very warm about them. They're beloved, they're very simple. But the reason for them being beloved, I think, is that people find in them, of course, universal feelings, but these tiny lines begin to be emblematic of the particular character and how the character is feeling, and we begin to know them, and it's a vocabulary and that we begin to recognize. And I think Schultz always wanted to make the strip visually pleasing. And he took enormous joy in the drawing itself, in drawing, you know, a downpour, a rain. He loved drawing rain. He loved drawing Linus's hair sticking up on end when he was surprised. He adored drawing Snoopy's ears. And that alone you could talk about for 20 minutes about why Mickey Mouse is a character whose ears are as stiff as shark fins. They're totally inexpressive.
They never move, no matter which direction Mickey is facing. They're always...
Right. And no matter what role he's playing, they're always the same. And that's, of course, Mickey's trademark, and that's why they become a universal symbol of Disney and commerce and all the rest, and,
right,
and imaginative commerce, I suppose. But the idea that Snoopy's ears are telling us stories themselves just by expressing all these emotions, and we know what Snoopy's thoughts are. We never know what's going on between Mickey's ears. He doesn't really have much of an inner life, but Snoopy did, and it brought us very close to Snoopy and brought us very close. The drawing itself... when Schultz, for instance, creates Snoopy on the doghouse, when he turned the doghouse sideways, when the doghouse began to be a kind of platform for Snoopy's thinking, he would wake up, for instance, covered in snow, and the line would show a single line without interruption, like a Calder mobile or a Calder statue, sculpture, showing this figure in space. And I think when you see his nose peering up from the doghouse or his pot belly, and just these small little... visually pleasing things, the empty supper dish, all those perfect little pen lines are things that Schultz took great pleasure in, and that where it seems to all be simple, where it all seems to be easy and simple, it's really he's doing little things like that all the time that you hardly notice that bring it into people's hearts.
So like Schultz himself, the characters are simple looking but complex.
I think they're a perfect expression of him, and I think the strip itself is a personal, very personal document. It's not unlike a diary at times, where he's recording things that are going on in his life. Of course, it is also pure art. There's nothing of his life at all in certain of the strips, but simply his understanding and recognition of human, you know, the human comedy. But where he was writing about his life, it is astonishing to me, and was astonishing as I went through in my daily. I took a sort of daily trip with Peanuts, where every day I'd go into a particular era, particularly if I was researching that time, or later when I was writing about a particular month in Schultz's life, I would just sit and carefully look and read at what was happening in the strip, giving, of course, always the lag time for the 3 to 6 to 8 week lag time, depending on how far ahead he was of his deadline. But even with those lags and having to calibrate dates accordingly, I saw a great deal more than I was expecting to find in the strip that was coming right out of his life. When Snoopy, you know, for instance, would suddenly chicken out of going to give a speech at the Daisy Hill Puppy Farm that he promised to give. And he comes back, and Lucy starts to torment him about, you know, why he's chickening out and why doesn't he have the nerve to go out into the world and do all this. Well, at the same time, to be learning that Schultz in his life was having some of the same struggles of not wanting to be on other people's schedules, not wanting to be out in the world giving speeches, wanting to be at home and coming home, and then his wife at the time, his first wife, Joyce, you know, saying, no, of course, you've got to go. You know, Yale University's called you the comic, you know, the humorist of the year. You've got to go get that award. Come on, you know, get back out there. There was certain parity to the dynamics of the characters, with Lucy and Charlie Brown, for example, that one could begin to see in his marriage. Certain aspects of the characters, of course, always are Schultz and always are coming out of Schultz. But to see Lucy at the end of Schroeder's Piano, beckoning him, trying to get his attention when his head is down, to recognize that Schroeder is bringing masterful works out of this small toy piano, this little instrument, and recognize that comics themselves were sort of thought of as a small little thing, a little instrument, that Schultz was bringing great works of art out of himself. And he really was a Schroeder figure at his drawing board, and people were, including his first wife, Joyce, were trying to get his attention, because he was very absorbed, not so much he very clear hours. He came home, you know, at the end of the day, and that was that. And he had weekends with his children, with his family. But when he was there, it was his absorption. It was his life. He was in control of the drawing board. And I think people, as they describe him there in the studio compared to Schultz outside, describe a very different guy. The guy at the drawing board was in control. The guy at the drawing board felt confident and knew what he was doing, and his hand had a mastery and a fluency that many other parts of his life didn't have. I think as a golfer, he showed some of the same mastery, and I think to some extent as a skater, as a hockey player, he also had some of the same sense of control and mastery. But it was things that he did with his hand-eye coordination always came naturally to him from the time he was a boy. And I think that the studio, when you spend time in it the way I did, researching, you really got a sense that it was the place in the world that he felt that he had mastered and that he was living most happily within.
We're discussing Charles Schultz with David Michaelis, his biographer. What about that negative space? You know, if you only had like 4 panels a day or 3 panels a day, you'd think you'd want to fill it up. He used a lot of negative space in the panels. Did the publishers approve of his style when he first began?
Well, they actually kind of threw down a challenge to him that he learned how to use, which was that Peanuts was sold at first to newspaper editors as a space-saving strip, which is to say that he would have to, a managing editor or composing a page could fill a space in by buying Peanuts as a comic strip and running it as a square, 4 panels, 2/2. They could run it horizontally. They could run it vertically. They could run it any which way and fill up space. He realized right away, and it was one of the first things he learned as a comic strip artist, was that he was going to have to struggle for attention, whether it was on the comics page or wherever they dropped the strip. And he had the smallest amount of space in some ways. I don't think anyone had a smaller strip at the time. And people were using, at the time, they were using black borders and all sorts of dramatic, heavy, dark areas to gain attention. And one of the best ways he discovered to counteract that was simply to use more white space. And he understood also that the more stark he could, more starkly he could evoke the characters, the more starkly he could draw them, the more crisp and simple the pen strokes, the more simplified their statements and the words and language they were using, the louder he was going to speak, and the more he was going to be noticed. And I think that he really figured it out quickly, and it's one of his typical masteries of cartoons and of the comic form. He really rendered in comic strip form things that used to be elsewhere. I mean, you never heard comic strip characters speaking the way they did. And also, he understood that drawing was extremely important. I mean, it was never corny. There was nothing trite in the drawing. There was nothing really even cute. He there was nothing extreme. He loved to have a warm quality, as I mentioned before, but he also loved for his characters to have a kind of mildness in the way they appeared, so that what they said then could be very, very strong. And I think simplicity was really the strip's genius. He made it look simple, but he kept the heart of it and the questing, the questioning, the searching of it. He kept that, I think, complicated. I think he always looked for the complications, and yet he kept it simple on the surface.
Your book, Schultz and Peanuts, has gotten a lot of critical acclaim and is surely going to be named one of the notable books of the year. But there's also been some controversy from the
mm-hmm.
family. What was it? Were you surprised that the family objected to the book? Or?
Well, I was surprised in one sense, technically, because it should be understood that I worked with the Schultzes for 7 years, and we formed very good working relationship and close relationship. And part of our agreement, and it was very important to me, was that the book, when it appeared, be at least as free from factual inaccuracies, these things that slip in over years, and that every book is plagued by to some extent or other. I found with my first biography, full-length biography of N.C. Wyeth, that to turn a final manuscript over to one or two members of a family, people who are close, you can weed out a lot of inaccuracies. And so I very much wanted the Schultzes to read the final manuscript, and we built it into our agreement that they would read and offer suggestions for factual accuracy, and that they would also make comments on my conclusions and make remarks, and that I would certainly consider all such remarks, but that we both and all agreed that an independent biographer was the only biographer Charles Schultz should have, that there should be a natural cut given to the author of the book, and that there would be no interference from the family on the author's conclusions, and that this was where Charles Schultz's integrity, the integrity of the family and of the author and the peanuts, would be best protected. There was no reason for me or for them or for, in fact, Peanuts to have a book created after Charles Schultz's death in which the family or a group of people, a committee, including his syndicate, would get together and decide what was in the book. That wasn't the kind of book we all agreed the book would be. So I was surprised, having given the Schultzes my final manuscript and giving them 3 to 4 months, where they did indeed supply me with at least some of them did, with their suggestions for corrections, to then be, when the book came out, to be filling the airwaves with accusations of betrayal and worse. It didn't actually match at all what had taken place. It was a very personal response, and I well understand why personal responses are have their own authority, and I wouldn't argue with that. But I don't think it matched the actual transactions and the actual work that we all did to make the book as correct as it possibly could be.
In any case, it's a small part, really, of the book, which is a portrait of one of the great artists of the 20th century, Charles Schultz. And the book is called Schultz and Peanuts, and the author, David Michaelis. David Michaelis, thank you so much for spending some time with us today on From the Bookshelf.
Thanks so much, Gary.
That's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. Hope you enjoyed the program. I'll be back again next week with another great show. In the meantime, you can check out our podcast page. Follow the links at kusp.org. Without the able assistance of Miss Breanne Beal, I would be sitting here each week talking to myself for 30 minutes. Thanks, Breanne. For KUSP, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.